Hello and welcome to recording number 12 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 8th, 2021. We're going to pick up the group with Gord had just been attacked by a giant green dragon. And then, in this chapter, we've jumped over to the evil group led by Abni the dwarf. And they've just talked about riding in the Hamlet, and rather than make notice of themselves to Verbabank, they don't want anything too bad to happen in Hamlet. And we're going to start here on page 116, paragraph 2. Stubborn, a broad-shouldered mountain dwarf, made a rude gesture at Keek in reply, but he did not argue. If Keek said that the boss wanted no trouble, then Stubborn had no desire to cross him. Abmi was one mean dwarf, and nobody to screw around with. Nothing that saw them cared to molest so ugly a group as this company was, and just as predicted. They rode into the village of Hamlet at the evening the next day. The inn of the Welcome Wench, accustomed to accommodating caravans, easily housed their number. There were suspicious looks, but no one questioned their money. Horses were fed and rested while the company dined heartily and slept in soft beds. Next morning, Abmi haggled with a pair of traders for provisions and a half dozen fresh horses. Then the company continued northward. They were watched by hard-eyed men-at-arms serving the local lord, but nobody cared to delay their departure. All right, break. So here we're guessing really quite the pass-through for Hamlet there. I just wonder who the local lord is. You know, whether it's Byrne or whether there's somebody else in this story here. We're really not given much of anything about Hamlet, except the inn can handle caravans and this fairly large number of men and dwarves, elves, and gnomes that are in this group. So, you know, the inn is able to handle all of them. It might be a little bigger than is pictured. If you scroll up on the fiction text from this point, you know, it's there's the map of the inn of the Welcome Wench. And down here, there's that's Byrne and... The fighter in red is it Rufus? I can't, you know, such classic figures. And there's the building of the first section of the there's the tower that's building, and the first to go up, and then a rather long walled structure. If you see the original T1 Hamlet maps, the plans for what they intend to be their bastion there are laid out, but just under construction at the time of T1. All right, I'm going to restart right here. We are on page 116, fourth paragraph down. Abmi was even more silent than usual, and he appeared haggard, as if a night spent in a feather bed was worse for him than one spent rolled in a blanket on the ground. Only the wicked dwarf knew the true cause of his condition. As he had slept, ebon tendrils had stolen into his brain, long slender tentacles as insubstantial as fog, yet strong as steel. The tendrils thickened and grew barbs that hurt cruelly, bringing him instantly awake and making him aware of what was happening. Uz was in contact, and his master was not pleased with Abmi's performance. The dwarf groveled mentally as the rasping voice of the Cambion spoke through the tendrils directly to his brain. Break. So here, you know, I'm not sure what those ebon tendrils are. It could be something that's already got a write-up, but I'm not really familiar with the speller ability that's allowing Abmi this long-distance communication. It's maybe something that had been implanted in Abmi originally by us, because that's, you know, that's quite a distance telekinetic or the mind reading is quite being done at a distance. All right, so it is page 116 and the second paragraph from the end. "Little fool," Uz shrieked mentally, "your stupid meandering and pillaging has left so broad and easy a trail that even idiot puppets can follow. You have it." At this question, Abmi thought of the misshapen object he guarded so carefully. He did so without meaning to, but Uz instantly caught the thought. "Good. Now I shall not have to waste a useful tool. You will live for a while yet, Abmi." Quivering in fear and rage, the dwarf sent a mental message in reply, while carefully masking the thoughts that lurked deeper within his mind. "Thank you, Lord of Evil, for your generosity. I'm your servant to do with what you will." "Enough," interrupted Uz. "I must hurry, for some great cloud is gathering, and in moments this contact will be broken. I cannot see what is around you, but it is dangerous, powerful. Good lies nearby, but some friendly force as well. I think, for this force is obscured and hidden. Perhaps it is a trap set by those righteous weaklings who seek to oppose me. No matter." Break. So here, whatever it is that Abmi is using, obviously something they're able to set up against. And he doesn't know what force is coming against him. He uses the idea of good, as they had used the alignment system here in, in the storyline, where Gygax actually introduced, the various alignments as actual, philosophies or, organizations within the storyline, which is a little different from him taking a mechanical abstract like alignments and showing how a representation of them. So here Uz is using the good as an actual, as an actual organized force. And then we have someone who's described as the Righteous Weaklings. And I'm not sure if that might be the Scarlet Brotherhood or the Hierarchs of the Horn Society or some other organization such as the Druids. And Chris has posted the spell telepathy. And it's not quite, what was being used by Uz with the ebon tentacles, but it is pretty much what was going. The distance is 186,000 miles, so it's quite a powerful little spell here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 117. Third paragraph. "Listen carefully and do not fail me. Leave immediately, but do so with caution. Go to Verbabank, being careful to be open and seemingly carefree. Once well beyond the town, leave an obvious trail to the northeast, doing what you have done previously, robbing, murdering, raping, burning. It must seem that you are on your way to Molag, understand?" "I understand, Lord," thought Abmi in reply. The wisps within the dwarf's brain sent tingling pleasure through Abmi's body. "Excellent, my faithful servant. Do well, and your reward will be all you can ask." And suddenly the tendrils were barbed and painful again. "But if you fail, such pain as this will seem a blissful reprieve from the torment you shall suffer. Now stop cringing and attend my final instructions." Leave those clods who serve you to their fate. Divide when you reach the At River. Send them on toward the lands of the Hierarchs, but you ride for your life northward. Enter the Vesev, and I will have an army there to greet you. The force will convey you in triumph to me in Daraka. But, Lord Uz, how am I to convince them to? Abi let the mental question trail off, for the tendrils were gone from his brain. He could sense that he was alone within his head. Hatred mixed with fear poured from the dwarf's mind, helping him to blank out the headache that the contact had caused. He said aloud, "Damn you, Uz, for the pig bastard you are. Someday I, Omni the Wild, shall become ruler of your realm, and you will cringe before me in abject terror at the fate I will bestow upon you." Then, not wasting further effort on his hatred, the dwarf began to lay his plans for accomplishing the orders of the Cambion Uz. All right, break. So here we have a little more about Omni, but also a seeming theme that all the evil characters seem to be, of whatever strength, seem to be just like Uz or, you know, the Hierarch, not the Hierarch, the Scarlet Brotherhood, High Priestess of Tharazdun, who commanded Candlekeep, the monk. They all seem to have this certain childish pettiness. And even where here Omni is imagining himself one day in a position to, squash Uz. There's a question if this is the same Omni as in G1. That was G3. Omni actually wasn't introduced in the G modules to G3 in the Fire Giants Hall. And, you know, I assume it is. Now, definitely that Omni came before this one. So I don't know if Gygax thought of just using this evil dwarf character or whether Omni had been fleshed out previously as an NPC or... Because I don't think Gygax really used too much. Oh, and here is an article from Dragon 287. Enter Omni. I can't read that myself. Chris, can you give me a summation of that?
It's pretty small, but it's written by Gygax, and it talks a little bit about Omni and, you know, where he came from and, you know, how he developed. It does mention the Giants modules.
All right. Does it say if he originated from them or somewhere else?
I didn't get to read the whole thing, so...
Okay. All right, we can catch on that at some other point. But yeah, it is interesting. Now, Gary Gygax at this point in Dragon 287, like the characters in his book, was an unreliable narrator. It's just that at this time... there had been a lot of bad feeling about the Greyhawk campaign. You can kind of imagine that after, after the problems he had first with losing the companies and then being sued while he was trying to get New Infinities, where the rest of the Gord books are written, and then the Lorraine Williams, who's running TSR, brought that down. And after that, I had always noticed that Gygax, he wasn't exactly a real trustworthy narrator on the past. And so a lot of things he said at that time, I think, you know, it depended on how he was feeling. And I just think a lot of things said were simply like, you know, like that episode of Saturday Night Live where Shatner... is giving a speech to a convention of Star Trek fans, and you know he just starts saying it was just a 3-year gig, you know, and with Gygax, I think there was a lot of bitterness after all this, so I'm not quite sure. And then I think that, you know, maybe he just simply didn't remember or made up stuff on the fly. So, you know, I'm interested, very interested to see this article, but I'm not all that trusting of what it is. It's absolutely amazing that you pulled this up. So, you know, I don't remember it myself, so I'm very interested at this point to see what he has to say about Obmi, no matter what.
I think it says that he originated in Castle Greyhawk, level 3.
Oh, he is an old character then. Wow. Yeah,
around 72 or 73.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's very interesting how early a character he is. All right. So, you know, we have the duplicitous plans here. And trying to distract anyone who's really following them to go after the larger group headed falsely to Molag and the Hierarchs of the Horn Society. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 117 and the final paragraph. 10 days later, the company turned on the train of pilgrims and merchants they had been accompanying, some as travelers, others purporting to be guards. Treachery and surprise enabled Obmi to succeed with surprising ease, and only 3 of his number were lost in the process. The company was near the crossroads that made the area important. A well-repaired road ran east and west from Furiundi to Valuna City, while another ran southward from Littleburg to Verbabank. The site was perfect, of course. Take everything of value, Gleed, and lead the men toward Divers. At the main fork, take the Willop Road. Your destination is Molag. The gnome stared at Obmi in surprise. Molag, what bad business have we with the Hierarchs? He asked. They will receive us happily and pay for our services and information. Am I to be questioned further? As he posed his question, Obmi placed his hand on his hammer. Gleed shook his head, but there was no doubt in the gnome's squinting eyes as Obmi went on. Keek and I will take the useless steeds and lay a false trail toward the north. You make sure that your trail is well covered by using only the road as long as possible. We'll lead any pursuit as far as Littleburg, lose ourselves there, and then come cross country to join you. Let us say Boulderford on the Vang River, 50 leagues north of Willop. Gleed thought a moment, then nodded. The gnome had mentally pictured the route and arrived at the conclusion that the two routes were of about equal length and would conjoin at the ford, just as Obmi had suggested. Break. So, right here, I like it that we're getting a kind of travelogue again. It was always one of my favorite parts of Saga, of Old City, where Gord was taking this route and giving little bits of information on the way. So we get a little bit of lore right here, and it's you know, about this crossroads, you know, between Furiundi to Valuna City, and another from Littleburg to Verbabank, and that it's very well used, well in repair. And then I guess the path northeast should lead to Divers, and then at the main fork you're going, they're taking off on a place called Willop Road, and heading toward Molag. And he hasn't quite convinced Gleed that that is the real destination, but maybe kind of reassured him that, you know, that they're going to meet up again on a place called Boulderford on the Vang River, 50 leagues north of Willop. But Obmi should obviously be doubted on any question. I mean, it just seems ludicrous that they would trust Obmi to do anything that was like in aid of this group where he's so careless. and doesn't mind killing off the members of his band. So I would, if I were, Gleed, I'd be very, very suspicious of Obmi acting in anyone else's interest. All right. I'm going to restart. We're on page 118 and the third paragraph from the end. An excellent plan, Master Obmi. The loot. Obmi shrugged his massive shoulders, feigning resignation. For once I have to trust you fully, Gnome. I must travel quickly and cleverly to lay the false trail, then be able to disappear. All the goods, even the silver and gold, must go with your group. I'm charging you with safekeeping of the spoils until I rejoin the company. Fail me, and I swear I will hunt you down and slay you. At that, Gleed grinned, then quickly replaced the look with one of sober acquiescence. Your orders, Obmi, are always faithfully followed by your servant, Gleed. Never fear, we shall be at the Boulder Ford as commanded. Give us 2 weeks. The dwarf scratched his beard, staring at Gleed as he did so, a mixture of doubt and consideration playing across his leathery countenance. Finally, he nodded. Let us say 2.5 weeks, 18 days, so that unexpected delays are covered. If you are not there within the allotted time, I shall seek you out, Obmi concluded with a threatening tone. 18 days, master. I will be there. The gnome went off then to gather the company, while Obmi sought out the skinny keek. This was almost too easy. Thanks to the greed of the gnome, Obmi thought as he smiled merrily to himself. A break. This is the end of the chapter, and it is page 119. That's chapter 10 that just ended. And again, just, I mean, Obmi is trying to be, duplicitous and trying to sound threatening to convince Gleed that he actually means it. But I just, I find it, it's amazing that Gleed would believe any bit of this, even if he is being threatened by Obmi to try to keep in character, that Obmi would not only do something in the interest of the whole group and not just himself, but also that he'd let the money, the spoils, go off with Gleed for any reason. So I think that is, just a little bit funny. Now, Chris has posted on the fiction text channel here the area map that shows, I guess...
Shows Willip and Molag. Willip on the near div, and then pretty much straight up from it, Molag.
Okay.
It's a large distance, so it was hard to get really granular on this one.
Yeah, you do see a road coming up from, coming up to Willip from the south. And there, then I guess we're going to see how easy it is. Is there anything that you notice on the Vang called Boulder Ford? I can't see anything myself.
Looking.
Yeah, now, there's a comment here that Obmi was correct to play on Gleed's greed. And this is one thing about Gygax's depiction of evil characters. And Gleed definitely wants to pilfer the loot for himself, or at least some portion of it. Maybe they haven't had time to really examine it well. It does play on, there is the sense that evil characters are mostly stupid. It really does seem that there is quite a bit of stupidity here. All right, and then on this, enhanced map here, that Chris is, we see Boulder Ford, and then we see Molag.
It's on the Vang.
And they're both on the Vang.
Yeah, that I guess it's the border, the red.
Yeah,
line.
I'm really not sure what the red lines mean, because you know, from the Darlene maps, there are no borders depicted. It's just a general map with like Furiondi splashed across a section, and the edges of it, you've kind of just got to imagine, which I kind of think is more in keeping with the idea of, that either the borders are ill-defined, or they may even, unless there's like a natural... Oh, and a red line on this map means a contested border. Yeah, and at the very end of it is across from Molag is Fort Belvoir. So it looks like we've got that in direct opposition to Molag. And then we see Skull Trail, which had led up to Uz's capital city, I believe. Because Molag was the summer city of Uz. And here now it's, I think it's supposed to now be the capital city of the Hierarchs, from what Abmi had mentioned previously in this book. All right, we are on chapter 11, page 121. I'm going to restart here, and this should be interesting, because this section is going to be more about Selene, and I don't really remember anything that has, dramatized Selene, so that we find out, we get a breath of life breathed into whatever bits of facts that we have from the setting material. All right, paragraph 1. The High Court of Selene was ablaze with light. Queen Yolanda was celebrating the midsummer with a grand ball this night. High above, carpets as green as the rich summer grass, dome ceilings showed the black velvet of the cloudless sky, with its myriad stars and the full faces of both moons, pale Luna and azure Selene. Fantastically carved and delicately wrought lanterns of all sorts, many with crystal and gems inset to refract the color their candles, competed with tapers reflected by mirrors of glass, copper, silver, and even gold, positioned throughout the many-chambered palace. The grand court was awash in golden light, while other courts and salons adjoining it were either dim or bright amethyst-hued, silvery, or illuminated so as to rival the cool depths of sea or ocean. All was harmonious and enchanting, each place exciting and different. As carefully as the dozens of chambers were lit, so too their furnishings were chosen, complementing and enhancing the effect of each area so too as pleased the eye. Plants and flowers were everywhere, likewise blending with light and color, adding their special fragrance to the hall or court they graced. Here, night-blooming jasmine was a centerpiece in a salon of deep blue. There, green fronds and leafy branches screened yet another alcove whose dim interior sparkled with a rainbow of little colored dots as bejeweled lamps turned and swayed. Pardon me.
And here's a comment about...
Yes, I lost you there. All right. The gems that flitted throughout the place, causing even candle flames to dance and bow in seeming rhythm to the sweet strains of elvish music that accompanied these breezes. Break. So, if you want to comment, but you're having trouble or don't want to do the because we are recording voice. If you'd like to type into if you get on the Greyhawk Fiction text channel here, you can type questions and such right into, and we'll answer and do different things. Now, this is a wonderful little bit about Selene. and her capital sounds, in a sense, it seems like we've been introduced to Draka and how horrifying that is. And then we see in this just the actual opposite, where Selene is the epitome of wonder and beauty. And I think you have to consider it to be probably far more beautiful than like even the most rich and aristocratic sections of the High Quarter in Greyhawk. So that it is, you know, truly, truly a place of enchantment. And even though Gygax's elves are not, they're not Tolkien-like elves, but at the same time, they are not just mere humans. And I think this is trying to show right here how Gygax considered this elven realm to be something very special. So I think what we really need to look at is how this is depicting a non-Tolkien but still enchanting elven society right here.
It sounds like a wonderful place.
Yeah, and I mean, since one of the breakaways, all the breakaways before have been this utterly evil. As is saying right here, that the elves are special, but they're flawed, and they aren't like these. They're only seemingly immortal beings by, you know, human standards, that they live so very long, but they're really not. You don't have them going back thousands of years or anything. So they are a race that it has its limitations in. And in a sense, it binds better with the human races. And from, you know, the game mechanic viewpoint, they have level limits, so that no matter how old they get, they're not going to be able to get, in first edition, they're not going to be able to go up and up and up and never ending, which, you know, would make these thousand-year-old elves, incredibly powerful. So I'm going to continue right here. Now we're getting, when they're talking about these courts and salons, there's some kind of structure here. And, it sounds like we have, this is the Grand Court, and, there's all these side courts, and each one is like a little different or set with various different, different enchanting chambers of, you know, like they're describing. There's a green bower, and one that is like depicts like the sea or the ocean, and reminds you of that. And so I'm going to restart right here. It is page 122, paragraph 2. The polished alabaster of the floor of the Grand Court bore no rug or carpet. Hundreds of slippered feet moved across its surface, intricately stepping to solemn air or sprightly melody. The dancers were begowned in silks and gossamers, garbed in velvets and satins, and glittering with cloth woven of precious metals. More glittering still were the arrays of gorgeous jewelry, diamonds, emeralds, rubies, sapphire, opals, and every other sort of gemstone imaginable. Gray elves and fairies in indigo, gold and white, purple, silver, and yellow, their high elven kin in soft hues of dove gray, blue, violet, green, and even a sprinkling of sylvan elves in chocolate brown and scarlet moved thus to the dance. With them were some few half-elves and humans, gnomes and halflings. These folk added still other dress and colors to the spectacle: orange, fuchsia, citrine, mauve, turquoise, pink, crimson, maroon, and even black. Obtrusive only by the contrast of their garb, archers in green and brown, and royal guards in silver chainmail, whose splendor was belied by the wood and steel of partisan and greatsword, stood rigidly along walls and in alcoved balconies. Even in such festive surroundings as these, precautions were taken. Break. So yes, again, more about the Grand Salon and some great interesting business about how the various races of elves and even some of the demi-humans are clothed in, you know, for this amazing event that's going on. And then we get the regular armor and garb of the archers and the men-at-arms who are standing around protecting the place. So we know it's also more than one level, as there are balconies with guardsmen and alcoves above it. So this is just sounding like quite a huge ballroom, courtroom right here. We even know what the floor is, an alabaster floor of the great court. All right, it's page 122, second paragraph from the end, and I'm going to restart. Silver horns and gold pipes sounded, and the throng parted so as to open a wide circle in the middle of the chamber. Coronets and diadems of noble lords and ladies formed the inner circle, and the handsome princes and beautiful princesses bent their knees and bowed their heads of platinum and gold tresses, raven-haired high elves, auburn-locked sylvan elves, too. The queen and her consort, fast old Dothmar, were taking the floor to dance the ritual steps of the midsummer frolic, the last formal requirement of the celebration. When it was completed, the audience would empty into the acres of wooded gardens and parks that surrounded the palace. There they would doff most of their excessive finery to trip and prance in dances and games of ancient elvish sort. This heritage could not be ignored by even royal elves when Richfest came and the twin moons of earth proclaimed midsummer's own night. Only when the sky paled and dawn came would the revelry cease. A break. So, again, you know, here we have, yeah, a little thing. Here is definitely something to note down about Richfest among the Selene and seemingly all the various elves that they are performing this, you know, this celebration here. It's noted it is noted here that high elves have black hair, sylvan elves have auburn red hair, and it should be added gray elves and even some half elves, they have platinum blonde or white hair, and supposedly also the violet eyes. And that comes from back with Evele, who was a half elf, and it's noted here that the gray elves have the platinum white hair. So there seems to be a link between the gray elves and the drow. Yes, it is. It seems very counterintuitive that the gray are equal to blonde white. Now, this is a moon festival because it's the double moons in the sky. I've just been, you know, working on some ideas for the Rene, and as I've been linking them, their priestess witches, who actually control the society, according to Gygax, with the worship of the moon, a moon goddess, and having control over lycanthropes. That's just something I'm doing for my own campaign. So Chris is mentioning that this seems like the only mention of Fastal Dothmar. And, you know, it's something that if you have can pull up the index that you can see if anything is noted outside of this.
Yeah, I checked, and it seems like it's only on maybe one or two mentions on pages 122 through 125 of Artifact of Evil.
Wow. So this is one of the characters or names that was taken from, was not taken from Saga of Old City. That's all I hear. Artifact of Evil. Forget what I'm reading here. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 123, second paragraph. Queen Yolanda and the tall Dothmar trod the steps of the dance alone for a full minute. Then, as protocol demanded, royalty joined them. And then nobility. so that after a few minutes the hall was a swirl of color and motion. Suddenly, the great doors at the far end of the chamber swung open. The rank guards in the antechamber beyond slammed spear butts loudly upon the marble squares of the floor, and a silver bell sounded, a reverberating note that caused the musicians to falter in their playing. Into the grand court strolled an old elf in mage's robes, with him a travel-stained druid, and behind them a straggle of others, likewise clad in motley, dirty garments. What impertinence! Not even the royal court mage would dare to interrupt so important and marvelous an occasion as this. Yet here came the old geezer, Unselvan now. The frowning crowd parted before his scowl, and his staff making loud clattering noises in the suddenly silent chamber, the court maid strode purposely toward the royal couple. Break right here. Here's a little comment. Gray elves lived in the mountains, so if they were underground, it makes sense to have white hair. No need for melanin in the hair. Of course, also no need to have gray, dark skin if underground. So they don't obviously didn't follow Earth-like evolution. Now, one thing that's got to be mentioned about the drow is that there is the particular radiation of the vault that may also be responsible for the dark skin color. And the, you know, like the vault of the drow isn't just, you know, a cavern in there. It's got that special ability that causes, according to the early D modules, for the superior enchantment of, you know, and a little bit of a dirty trick back then where you would take these wonderful weapons of, like, you know, +5 swords and then have them disintegrate on you once you had left the underground. And it is, it's a very good question that, how related are the gray elves and the drow? Obviously, there was a point where there hadn't been, you know, a kind of Vulcan-Romulan drift between the two groups. So, you know, at some point, the drow may have been a branch of the gray elves themselves. So it's not said right here, and I don't remember it being commented on in earlier work. And then the drow were kind of lifted into various other places, and especially Forgotten Realms. So the a lot of the information that came about of them afterwards, you know, became very, you know, mixed and, you know, very hard to keep track of which setting they're talking about. All right, I am going to restart. We've been introduced to Unselvan, the old, which, and as said here, how old an elf would have to be old geezer, the old royal court mage. This is page 123 and the fourth paragraph. "How now, Unselvan," called Dothmar, "you disturb the queen. Not to mention our noble guests," noted Yolanda softly. She then turned her lilac-colored eyes to Unselvan, and his incongruous entourage. "There had better be a good reason indeed, cousin, for this outrageous intrusion on our revel." "Your Majesty," Unselvan said with a slight bow. "Your Royal Highness," he added, nodding his head toward the outraged Dothmar, "I came with grave and dire news, and I must crave your Majesty's forgiveness and immediate attention." "Crave? You demand, not beg," sputtered Dothmar. But Yolanda laid her slender white hand upon her consort's arm, and he shut his mouth in a grim line. "How dire, maid, say softly now." Unselvan shook his head slowly. "The gravest," he replied to the queen, in a voice that only the three of them could hear. "Prince and princesses, lord and ladies," said Yolanda, in her clear voice, "I must speak a few words with our mage and his honored guests. You have our permission to resume the frolic, and when we return, the revel shall proceed henceforth to the parks and greenery." on break, it's commented here that, as I was saying about the drow and their incredibly powerful armor and weapons, that it's very classical fairy tale that the powerful magic melts in your hands eventually. But, you know, and that is true. Sometimes on daylight, you know, the magic will be destroyed or fade, like Tolkien's ogres. And I think in you know, several other things, there's always coming from the underground caverns of the Cidae, who, you know, magic amounts of time could pass, or that the clear light of day was always something that, like iron, would break a lot of the magic within these things and people. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 124 and the second paragraph. The musicians resumed their playing as queen, consort, and mage went without unseemly haste through a short hallway to a paneled and frescoed audience room suitable for the urgency of the need. At Anselvan's beckoning, the group of strange guests followed, and a squad of the queen's guards brought up the rear. "Out with it, cousin," Yolanda demanded of the royal mage as soon as they were in the room. "I do not desire to keep my court dancing for hours." Anselvan again bowed slightly. "As your majesty commands." "These are warriors fighting for light," white-haired old elf said, indicating the eight adventurers with a sweep of his arms. "Dismiss the guards, for these are the bearers of intelligence, which only you two must be privy to." The queen nodded and the guards withdrew. The mage then related the whole business succinctly, finishing with the fact that an agent of the hated Uz was thought to have the precious third of the artifact created to restore evil to the world. "Here, for yourself, I present Druid Greenleaf, Lord Geller, Lady Deirdre, a fellow mage Oscar, Agent Gord, and the doughty fighters Inkose, Moon, and Patrick." Each of the visitors bowed deeply as the queen and consort acknowledged the brief introduction. "Tell us now of your mission," Dothmar instructed, "so her majesty may make full her understanding." Geller, with appropriate homage, stood forth a step and related the beginning of the affair. The ruler of Selene glanced at her consort and nodded, acknowledging that she was aware of the alliance to prevent evil from accomplishing its goal. The half-elf then concluded the rapid narration. Greenleaf had assumed the coordination of things once the party had been assembled. "Your undertaking serves Selene as well as all other states of goodwill," said the queen. "So we will now lend what assistance is possible. It is time for our return to the revels," she said, with a worried expression playing across her delicate and strikingly beautiful features. "But we will send our constable to you soon. Anselvan, you have our leave to take these stout and goodly folk to the guest chambers of the royal wing of the palace. See that they are given all they need to refresh and rest them. The constable will join you soon." Break. Yeah, and it's I can check on that to see if Sergeant actually did use Anselvan. And a very fake comment, Chris notes, that Yolanda does not want to keep her court dancing for hours.
I've seen certain things where fairies have kept people dancing until they bled and died.
I think that Gygax did a very good job here of depicting the royal and ancient queen of Selene. You know, it's an ancient kingdom, older than the human kingdoms around them. I think she did a very good job, and with Dothmar, showing how Dothmar seems a little more hidebound about following these customs. So I think Gygax really, he did capture that feel of, and the feel that Gord and Curly and Geller, they all know how to act you know, while facing such a power and a queen as Yolanda. Now, it's mentioned that Onselvan is only in Artifact of Evil and the LGG, so it doesn't look like Sargent had mentioned him. I did miss things in the index, so it's possible. But again, this is dealing with Selene, and I don't think Sargent covered really quite as much territory with Selene as he did, say, like the Great Kingdom and such. All right. I'm going to restart. We get to see who the constable is. And it is page 125, paragraph number 2. Yolanda and Dothmar departed then, as Onselvan and the tired and worn adventurers once again made appropriate obeisance. The court magic user then beckoned for the others to follow him, and without further word, he turned his back on them and strode from the room, taking a small passage screened by Arras. "Come on, Gord," Geller urged the young thief. "You seem to be thunderstruck. What's wrong?" One-eyed bard grabbed Gord's upper arm and began towing him along. "She is more beautiful than any other woman I have ever seen," Gord replied dazedly. "Even Evely, and they could be sisters." "Yes, Lady Evely did show a strain of fairy heritage, but that's magic gone from the wand, if you will. It's our purpose now which is important, so pay attention, understand." When Gord nodded, Geller saw his expression and added, "If you must look for substitutes for your lost lady love, don't look at queens, and do it when our quest is complete. Selene is open to you, and the fair damsel of the court will receive you well, provided we triumph." Break. All right, so once again, Gord shows his still is, you know, being awestruck and very susceptible to any beautiful woman he comes across. Now, definitely the Queen of Selene is supposed to be staggeringly beautiful, but still it's kind of showing Gord, you know, and it's
magic gone from the wand.
Yeah, I like that term. We have to note that one for use as a Greyhawk, one of the Greyhawk comments. And yeah, he likes those violet eyes quite so much. It's, you know, and of course, you know, it'll later stand him actually in good stead, you know, as we're going to get up to the meeting with the drow. Now, I wanted to note also that we're hearing more about this grand palace structure, about there's a royal wing. There is, you know, it's the palace. So there's all this other stuff within, and it sounds gigantic. You know, the palace there of in Selene sounds truly gigantic. Now, we don't know what else is around Onstad and how the city actually looks, but however it's determined, it should have a large palatial structure, and then woods and parks completely surrounding that. So, you know, we've got a little more information here, and that's one of the things I love about the travelogue business with Gord, is we get these brief descriptions of all these cities and towns and places throughout the Flaness. And while we're not giving an overwhelming bit of information, we are giving little hints and bits and pieces that we can develop further later on. You know, Gord is still thinking here of Evely, and he still seems to have his quite a bit of the Romeo left in him. All right. We're near the end. I'm going to restart. It is page 125 and the second paragraph from the end. About then, they came to a rather plain room, whose curving wall indicated it was in a tower. The constable, Parsifal, met them there and escorted the group to his private quarters. The noble elf's party dress contrasted sharply with the austerity of the furnishings and the martial trappings that adorned the walls. But Parsifal seemed unaware of the incongruity of his appearance in these surroundings. Despite his rather foppish guard, his manner was hard and direct. Queen Yolanda had told him but little of the matter, so once again the druid and bard explained, with many additions this time, by Deirdre. This bothered Gord, for the constable seemed too fine-featured and handsome to him, and Deirdre's participation in the account all too obvious an attempt to flirt with the noble Grey Elf. How easily, he thought bitterly, women's heads were turned by pretty men. Right, and, you know, the irony of that coming from Gord is just unbelievable. I mean, you know, that is, of course, the little planned humor by Gygax, but Gord, who for now into deep into the second book, is still overwhelmingly influenced by, a good-looking woman. It's just, you know, and his rather Romeo, in the play, Romeo is the worst kind of, he would flit from woman to woman to woman, so that at the beginning it is just amusing. He is the most inconstant lover that imaginable at the beginning of the Romeo and Juliet, which is, you know, part of the irony of the play. So here, Gord is actually, you know, projecting. Gygax projects a lot of jealousy on Gord when dealing with Deirdre. And obviously, I'm wondering if Parsifal, who's, I believe, one of the Knights of the Round Table, whether he is a character, maybe, that somebody played, because Gygax doesn't usually steal names of import to add to his own NPC characters. He likes fooling around with his own name. He likes making up names on the fly, some good, some bad. And it seems a little strange that he would use such a well-known character name, but not that maybe a well-known player character might have used it. Let's see where we're at. Okay. We're still pretty well. We've got a few pages left of the. I'm coming off choppy tonight. Unfortunately, we're right at the end of the evening, so and not really much I can do. Okay. Yeah, it may be, you know, we've had a few problems with Craig, including the voice, it breaking and having to do two parts. It's Craig, huh? Well, you know, at this point, it's the end of the night. We're at 6:58. We've really covered a lot of ground. Now, there's a lot of information in even the Ob-Me-Uz sections of this, but I have to say I find them to be a bit uncomfortable reading, and I much more prefer, like, this bit about Selene. There's been a lot of action in the story so far. This is chapter 12, and we're really kind of going through the story fairly quickly. So, I think it's very nice to hit this section on Selene, where we're getting a lot of background material, and some idea. More than just discussing the palace in Nonstad. It's very nice to see how the queen acts, how the upper court acts. Now, we're not really seeing what the common elves, even if they're high elves or gray elves, what these elves are like. Now, I assume that Yolanda is a gray elf, because I think they mentioned her platinum hair. So we're not really getting much about the regular gray elf, but we are getting a good example of how the royals and the nobility are acting. Dothmar is, again, a good example. He is just a prince consort, so he's not part of, the royalty per se. I mean, he might be married in, from another branch of the royalty. But definitely, Yolanda is from the primary ruling family. So it's also interesting to note that, that they have Yolanda being able to be, the queen that the elven society, accepts the female rulers, which was not, all the time in earthly, our world's history. So it is, we do get this variety. Now, I have always thought that, Selene should be, not exactly Tolkien, Lorien kind of thing, but definitely have something about it that sets it apart from simply a human society. Because it's very much older. The people live a lot longer. And they have seen, their society be driven further, in fact, by the humans. So I like it that hopefully they will keep up with the idea that it is not just humans with pointy ears, and try to keep up the Selene Elven Society as something a little special. All right, well, we're having a little technical difficulty. It's 7:01, so I'm going to call up Craig. And I'll just wait for this last commentary here, or if anybody has anything they want to add. All right. Okay. I'm calling in Craig and kicking him out. So